and welcome to the Behind the Brawl podcast brought to you by Barbell for Boobs, where we strive to redefine the standard of care in breast health and improve quality of life post-diagnosis. I'm your host, Ziana Hansen, and the founder of this incredible organization. Thank you for joining us. Today, we have Michelle McGree, a breast cancer survivor and overall just badass. Welcome to the show, Michelle.
Hi, thank you. I love it.
I love it when women just claim badass. When it's just like, yes, I am a badass. Put that in my description.
Absolutely.
So that's pretty incredible. So I'm going to start the show off. Obviously, you're here to share your breast cancer story. I always like to start with the same question every single time, because I think it's so important for us to know, who are you, Michelle?
Oh, man.
So take us back to kind of like, how did you grow up? Where did you grow up? What kind of, did you play sports? Like, what was your upbringing all the way up to? Kind of give us that little clip of who you are, or who you are leading up to the day before you were diagnosed with breast cancer.
Yeah.
3, 2, 1, go.
yes. So I am from Helena, Montana. This is where I was born. And I grew up in a very large extended family. My dad came from a family of 9 and my mom had a family of 7. So tons and tons of cousins and extended family. I've got a brother and sister myself. So we, you know, just grew up as probably pretty normal kids in Helena, Montana. I played soccer as a little kid, and I really loved that. When I was leaving high school, I decided I wanted to get out and see the world. So that took me to Portland, Oregon. And at the time, I thought I was going to study genetics and find a cure for Alzheimer's, because that's what my grandmother had. But I ended up falling into fisheries biology. So sort of took a big redirect.
I'm like, say that again.
Fisheries biology. So I took a biology course. You grew up fishing in Montana. You kind of like being outdoors. But I just got into like fish as things, you know, like trying to learn all about what they are, what they do. And, fishing and recreation is a big part of what we do in Montana. And so I just kind of like decided it was something I was kind of into and wanted to see where it went. So I started working for agencies out there that do fish work. And I don't know, just got into fish. So I went to grad school in Colorado.
So on the fishing biology, here's, you know, I'm just a small time Southern California girl. This would totally not even enter into my life at all. What kind of career does that take you to? Like, if that's what you're studying, what does that future look like? Only because I am completely naive to this major and study. I feel like I'm pretty hip. I feel like I have no idea. I'm going to assume that a lot of our listeners do not either.
Yes. Well, you can do research. You can teach. But what I was most interested in, and sort of what I'm doing now, is more like managing fish populations. So obviously fish are found in the wild, and they do their own thing. They have for a lot of years, but in order for people to be able to go fishing, and because people take them out of the streams and eat them for dinner and everything else, we need to be able to put science behind having healthy fish populations in a river or a lake or ocean. And so there's actually a lot of science behind it in terms of, do you need to stock fish? How many do you let people take out? Do you try to fix the habitat? So, you know, when someone goes to a stream and just like throws out a line and tries to catch a fish, there's actually a lot of work that goes into making sure there's fish in the stream. So that's kind of,
and obviously that making sense. Sure that the fish is healthy for them to be catching and eating. Is that a piece to that?
It is. Yeah.
Is there any control when it comes to to, you know, just open water. Obviously that's a massive, you know, cause you see people fishing off the pier in Southern California all the time. And I'm like, is that really safe?
Yeah. You know, ocean stuff is like a totally different, thing. And that's kind of why I went back to the mountains cause it's just, there's just so much that goes on there. But yeah, there's a lot of people that work with fish. Well, I shouldn't say a ton, but, at least in Montana, there's a lot of people that are here trying to make sure that we have good fishing. I mean, recreation in Montana is like one of our biggest industries. So, I just became interesting to me. And honestly, I love science. And I love like the management of things and behavior and all that stuff. So it's just, it's a career that I've got into kind of by accident, but I've really liked.
Well, I think that it also takes you back to like your roots and really where you come from. So I think that when you can take something that almost is your foundation and basically like who you are and is a representation of where you come from, and then being able to align it with a study, like if you're an analytical person or a researcher, to be able to kind of mirror those, you know, I look at Barbells for Boobs as I've always wanted to help women. And then, you know, I took a barbell, which is something where I feel so confident and comfortable, and that's my home. And then taking this very scary, scary thing and making change or doing something with, you know, having that foundation of, well, I feel confident here in this place, so let me build from here. So even though it sounds like a mistake, it probably is. I think that a lot of us do it and think it's a mistake, but we're really just finding what feels like home for us in our studies.
Yeah. And I think for me, it's less about the actual fish and more about creating opportunities for people to be able to go fishing or spend time with their families and trying to preserve that for future generations. I think that's probably the most rewarding part about working in fisheries. So
that's amazing. And so you go on, you got your BS in this and then went on to receive a master's degree. What was that studying in?
Yeah, so this is where it sort of starts getting interesting when it comes to breast cancer, because, and I didn't have breast cancer at this time, but I went to Colorado State University to study fish, wildlife, and conservation biology, and I ended up doing a master's project on endocrine disruption and wastewater treatment plants. So basically, what it was a study below Boulder, Colorado, where they had a lot of hormones going into the wastewater from, you know, people using birth control and then peeing, and it goes to the wastewater and out to the stream. And so it was having an effect on fish populations. And so my study was to look at that and give estrogen to fish in a laboratory to see what happened to them. And so I actually gave fish estrogen in a laboratory setting to see if I could get the males to basically lose all their male characteristics. And it was really interesting because they lost, the males that got had estrogen lost all their behaviors. They couldn't reproduce. And it was just like, it was for a master's project, it was just so significant in that it was a very obvious result of having estrogen in the wastewater. Not a good thing for fish, but it was interesting that then, you know, years later, I kind of fall into the breast cancer realm. So
that's incredible. You only gave the estrogen to the male fish.
Yeah,
that was like was basically what the purpose of the study was. That's incredible. And did you stay in Colorado for a little bit of time after you finished your master's, or did you automatically go back to Montana just knowing that's where you wanted to end up?
No, I stuck around Colorado for a while. I went down to Pueblo and worked for the state doing fisheries work for a couple lakes and reservoirs down there, just trying to manage the sport fish population. And that's where I had my first breast cancer diagnosis, was down in Colorado.
And let's kind of talk through that. Was how, number one, how old were you and how did you become aware of it?
So So I was 28 at the time. I was living by myself. I think I was, I was even single at the time. And I just started having blood come out of my nipple. So like I would go to bed and I'd wake up the next day and there would be like blood on my pillow or on my shirt. And I thought, man, that's not right. And so I kind of was like, well, maybe I scratched myself. Maybe it's no big deal. So after a couple days, I called my cousin, who's a doctor, and I was like, should I be worried about this? And she's like, you know, it's not that big of a deal, but you should go get it checked out. So I went to a doctor in town who was like, yeah, this is really common for a person your age. I'm sure it's a papilloma. We'll just go in and remove it and everything will be fine. You know, no mention of cancer at all. So that's what I did. I went in and had surgery. And then I remember going to the follow-up appointment with nobody. I didn't even think to bring anyone because it wasn't going to be anything bad. And I walked into the doctor's office and he was like, well, turns out that it's cancer. So you should really think about plastic surgery, freezing your eggs. Here's a pamphlet and see you next time. It was ridiculous.
Wow. How long ago? What year was this in?
It was 2011. Yeah.
2011. So you're 28. At that time, did you, in your head, were you at all thinking breast cancer?
No. No one even said, hey, there's a slim possibility, but it could be breast cancer. No one had ever said that to me. And so I was totally I was alone.
Yeah, I think that that's the most incredible part to even, you know, my breast cancer story, my best friend's breast cancer story when she was 26. Breast cancer just wasn't even on my mind at all.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So you had a very dull appointment with your doctor. And then what was the next part that happened?
Well,
I mean,
I think he assumed that I was had a genetic mutation, and so the first, you know, sentence out of his mouth was, you really need to go freeze your eggs, you need to do all of these really extreme things. And at that point, you know, it turned out that I had DCIS, you know, stage zero, so it was contained, and I was not genetically positive for anything that I was tested for at the time. And so I had more choices than I think he thought I was going to have. But I was, you know, I felt really alone. My family was in Montana. I was single. I had not ever thought about breast cancer before. So I was not connected to, you know, any organization at that point. I started trying to do all the research and outreach myself. And ultimately at the time I decided to do a double mastectomy, because I didn't want to have to worry about it ever again. Because I know myself and I worry quite a bit, and it was important to me to have some symmetry, because I was still in the dating world and I didn't want to have to deal with that on top of everything else too.
Now, when it came to freezing your eggs and kind of making those decisions at such a young age, I think it's hard, especially, you know, when I was 28, I wasn't thinking about becoming a mother or getting married or anything like that. What was happening in your own mind? And if you can kind of go back and say, did you even have time to make those types of decisions, to even think about that, to consider, you know, my best friend, Ceci, she was 26, 27, actually, by the time she went and did all her surgeries, she preserved one of her breasts because she wanted to breastfeed. Like, she had that foresight, and she just had a baby. Being able to watch her breastfeed with one breast right now is so incredible to me, because I was like, just take them both. Like, you don't need them.
Yeah.
What was going on with being young and knowing, like, hey, I might want to be a mom, or what kind of, talk through those decisions.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's so much urgency that comes with a diagnosis that it's hard to really know what to do, because there are places out there that'll help you with that financially and stuff. But there's so much urgency in just get this stuff out of me that it's hard to really have a clean and clear head about what you might do and how you might even pay for it. And luckily for me, like, it was DCIS, so chemotherapy wasn't on the table for that one. But, you know, a double mastectomy, like you said, was. And it was something I had to think about in terms of, okay, if I do this, I wouldn't be able to breastfeed. But, you know, at least there's formula and there's some options there, which aren't good options. But for me, I just knew that the worry of leaving some breast tissue was the most important thing to me. So I went with double mastectomy, and I was glad that I did, because they ended up finding DCIS in like 4 or 5 places and atypia on the other side. And so I'm glad. And I think you just have to kind of trust your gut with what you feel like is right for you and move on.
Yeah. I think those are such hard decisions to make, and they're all individual decisions. And one of the things I always say is I think our podcast is a great place for anybody that's newly diagnosed, so that you can hear these stories and hear the different decisions that are being made and the why. And because I think that just number one, getting the diagnosis, you're shocked. And now you have to make these very critical life changing decisions pretty quickly. And when you're young, especially the decisions you have to make are a little bit harder.
Oh yeah.
So you get your double mastectomy, you go back. How long was your treatment in total during that diagnosis?
I think I was diagnosed early July. I had my double mastectomy early August, and I was back to work by September. So it was, you know, not fun, but it wasn't horrible. I had a nipple reconstruction and nipple tattoos that I did after that. So that took a little bit of time, but, you know, not having to go through the radiation and chemotherapy and all that other stuff definitely made the recovery, I don't know if I would say faster. I mean, obviously, like, you can move quicker, but a double mastectomy is no joke. You know, it takes a long time to, like, get sort of recovered from that. It's, I think, years probably, you know.
Yes. And I also think that people believe that a double mastectomy and a reconstruction is like you have these brand new, fabulous looking new breasts. And I don't think that's really the case, because there's still scars. No. And it's not done so like politely and so with such grace as if you're paying for, you know, breast implants. And I think that people, there's this conceived notion that that's what it's like. Oh, I'm getting new breasts. And it's like, you know what? I'd rather not. I'd rather not have breast cancer to get new breasts. But I've definitely heard that before of like, well, at least you got new boobs. You know, it's like, what?
Like, oh, I know. And I went through the whole nipple reconstruction, nipple tattoo thing, because I didn't want to look at myself every day in the mirror and be reminded of what happened. I wanted to like, just be sort of normal, like at a glance, be like, yep, boobs, get in the shower. And so I think to some people, they'd be like, why would you even bother that? But to me, it was so important to be at least somewhat normal again that I went through that extra step.
And did you ever have, knowing that you caught it so early at stage zero and you did not need chemo or radiation, did you ever have any guilt with that? Or did you ever struggle with your, you know, identifying yourself as a breast cancer survivor? Did you go through any of that?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think, you know, when you're stage zero, you feel like you can't even claim being a cancer survivor, even though you can. I mean, it's interesting for me because, like, obviously, spoiler alert, I had a recurrence. But, you know, at stage zero, I was like, I didn't go through everything else everybody else did. I don't know if I, you know, deserve to be in the same room. But now looking back, like hearing the words, you have cancer, I mean, that's universal. Anybody that has to hear those words, like you're in the club, like, you know, it's horrible. And granted, everyone has their own story and everything can be, you know, treatments are different and side effects are different. But I mean, it sucks for everyone. And I think if I could go back to myself back then, I would definitely give myself a little bit more grace, knowing, okay, you're not stage four, but what you're going through is still shit, you know?
I think that when Ceci was on the podcast, and I always mention this to anybody that's on that stage zero diagnosis level, she was very, just said it so beautifully, was because she had that same, even, I mean, I was so loud about her story because she wouldn't tell anybody because she had so much shame that it was stage zero, that it wasn't really cancer, that she wasn't going to make a big deal about it. And I made a very big deal about it because I was like, you still went through something. And what she said on her podcast with me is, you know what? I think that we should be celebrating stage zero more because that means we're catching it earlier. So she's like, I'm thankful that I caught mine at stage zero, and we should all be celebrating whenever we find out somebody's stage zero, because that means that they don't have to go through that aggressive treatment. Like, why would we want that for anybody? And I thought it was such a beautiful perspective for stage zero survivors to say, man, we caught it early. Let's like celebrate that. That's a great thing for us as women, for us as a breast cancer community. So such a beautiful perspective for me. So I always like to share that with my stage zero. But now we can continue on because it goes beyond that for you.
Yes. So I went through that. I went, back to work and everything. And then talking about stage zero, like having cancer shifts things in your life. And throughout this time, so a couple years went by, and I realized that I just really wanted to be closer to family. So my family was still up in Montana. They're still very tight. I see them a couple times a year. My nephew at this point is a couple years old, but he doesn't really know my name, or he doesn't know the difference between me and my sister. And so I'm like, you know what? This isn't working for me. I need to try to get up to Montana. So I start looking for jobs with the state up here, and I ended up getting one, moved up to Montana, started thinking about my 5-year cancerversary party, and I go on vacation, and I get in the shower, and I'm like, geez, I feel a lump. That's not right. But I'm thinking, you know, when I get a double mastectomy, they tell you like your chances of getting cancer back is like less than 5%. Or maybe 1%. I don't even know. So I'm like, it's not cancer. It's got to be like a cyst or something. So I don't really worry too much about it. But I go home and I make an appointment with my oncologist and go through the whole biopsy, ultrasound, which is more complicated because I have implants. So they can't really see anything very well. So we get through that whole thing, and I remember going to the doctors and thinking, okay, last time this happened, I was by myself, so I'm not doing this again. So I brought my sister-in-law with me, who's BRCA positive, and she's an oncology nurse, just awesome human being, and I knew she could be there for me. And I'm sitting in the room, and I remember the nurse navigator comes in with a notepad, and I thought, oh, shit. They don't bring notepads into appointments that are okay. So anyway, luckily my oncologist walked in and just said, you know, it's not what we wanted. And that was awful. Knowing that I had cancer again. So, went through all the testing that time again. And this time it was, triple positive. So estrogen, progesterone, and HER2 positive. And I knew that basically the cancer had grown from whatever cells were left and grown into the muscle because I didn't have breast tissue left. So I had to get a specialized surgeon in Seattle. I didn't have to, but I wanted to. And went through that whole thing, but it ended up being in my lymph node and like protruding out of my lymph node. So it was like extra aggressive, which is always what you want. So that was my second diagnosis.
So I think this is a really interesting topic, especially to talk through. You're not the first woman that I've met that has had a, you know, double mastectomy, thought all the breast tissue was gone, and then having a reoccurrence. I know that you probably know Allison Lyle. I remember going through this with her. She was like, there's just nothing there. Yeah. How is there another diagnosis?
Yeah.
So if you can talk, since you are kind of a scientist, talk to our audience more about how does that actually happen when you have removed your breast tissue for breast cancer to come back?
Yeah. So when they remove your breast tissue, they remove as much as they can. And they remove as much as they think is breast tissue. And, you know, without being a surgeon or being in that room while they're doing the surgery, I'm not sure, but I know that it is impossible for them to get every single cell. And so all you need is one, right? one cancer cell to start growing and then keep growing. And that's what you have. So I think, you know, in retrospect, it would have been awesome to have radiation on top of what I was doing already, but that's not standard of care. And, you know, it's probably overkill for people, but, you know, I wish that in hindsight. Yeah, I mean, I think for myself, for Allison or anybody else who's had this experience, it's just for whatever reason, there was a breast cell or a couple breasts or cancer cells that were left in there that just decided to go crazy and become a tumor and move around. So, you know, it's like, I know like statistics, right? So I'm like a science person and I know this graph of 5%. Well, somebody has to be in that 5% and it just happened to be me.
Isn't that crazy? And what now was the stage? What was the treatment plan? What did that feel like for you to have to now make these decisions the second time around? Like, again, we all CrossFit here, right? So feels like doing Fran the second time isn't as hard as the first time. How did it feel like second time going through this decision-making, treatment, stages, like, where was your mind at? Number one, where were you at in all of those things? And then where was your mind at?
Well, so it was stage two. So it's stage two because it was in my lymph nodes. And luckily I caught it early because with implants, it kind of pushes everything up and I was able to find it when it was pretty small. But, you know, like I was sort of proud of the fact that with stage zero DCIS, I didn't have to do chemotherapy. I didn't have to lose my hair. All of that stuff. And, you know, when I got diagnosed the second time, the stakes are higher. It's scarier. There's a lot more you have to do. And, you know, I got second opinions, but everyone said, you know, like, obviously this is chemo, this is radiation. We need to be aggressive. And I remember like when my doctor told me that I had to have chemo, like I just was destroyed. You know, it was like, I know hair is not a big deal, but to me, I was like, I don't want to lose my hair. You know, I don't want to lose everything and I don't want to have to go through this. And it was devastating. And I think the fact
number one, I apologize for comparing your second diagnosis to a CrossFit workout. So next that, I'm trying to make light of how serious this is. So how old were you in this for the second diagnosis? You must have been what, 33?
32. Yeah, it was 4 years, 4 years later.
4 years so, after.
Yeah. It was, Yeah.
And having to go through chemo now.
Yeah. So having to do chemo now and, you know, my sister-in-law, she's an oncology nurse. So I remember she sat me down and was like, this is going to suck. But luckily I was home. I had family. I had a boyfriend who was living with me at the time who could cook for me and feed me and, tell me everything was going to be okay. And, it was just an extremely hard time in my life. And at the time I didn't know how I was going to get through it. So I literally got through it hour by hour sometimes. But you know, you just have to do it. And I'm glad that I am where I am now, but It's devastating, especially because every time you turn around, it seems like someone's telling you it's aggressive. You know, it's like, it's never good news. It's always like, it's high grade, it's aggressive, it's blah, blah, blah. So it's hard.
So did you, so you did chemo. How long now in the second diagnosis, how long was your treatment during the second time? How long was your chemo? And did you have radiation at all? No, yeah, you can't.
Yeah, I did. So this is, at this point, my implants are 4 years old. So the scar tissue has been established, which is a big deal for radiation. So I had 3 months of chemo. And then a year of Herceptin, which is that targeted therapy for HER2 positive people. And then I had surgery after chemo. So I had to do a couple different lumpectomies to get the tumor out of the remaining tumor out of my muscle. And then I had to do radiation, and it was the aggressive radiation because I still had residual cancer that they had to remove. And then I've been on hormone therapy for almost 4 years now. So whereas my first diagnosis seemed like a pretty short treatment regime, this is like the marathon. So now I feel like I'm an expert in all things. I've done it all.
Well, I think that, you know, having that guilt of stage zero and then having to go in and really experience, you know, this higher level of treatment and this higher level of just stress that's put on your body. And knowing, I think that it's almost, it's really beautiful that you understand both of them, because I think that in our community, especially for me, you know, my first diagnosis that I received from a loved one was a stage zero. My second diagnosis with my sister was a stage four. And so I think that sometimes things come into your life so that you can get kind of smacked on the butt, smacked on the back to kind of create that awareness and say, hey, this happens to people. And then you become educated and engaged. And I really do think that Ceci's diagnosis was me preparing for my sister's diagnosis. And, you know, you have to sometimes think like, okay, maybe the state, maybe that first thing helped me prepare for this greater thing for me to hear that you went through a double mastectomy at a young age because you were scared and you already knew that. And you already knew that you had anxiety. You would have stressed out about it. I think that if you would have started in a more aggressive treatment, that would have been just more traumatic for you as a person, right? So we never know what happens to us, or, you know, why life is the way it is, but it's honestly just creating your own understanding.
Right. And I think, you know, after my first diagnosis, I knew I really wanted to be a breast cancer advocate, and help people. And I think that one of the reasons, if I had to like say everything is for a reason, one of the things that is really great about my second diagnosis is that it taught me how to help people in a deeper way. So I can connect to people and be like, I know about chemo. I know what it feels like to go through X, Y, and Z because I've been there. And honestly, it has made me a better advocate, not only for people who need help, but for metastatic cancer survivors or just people who go through metastatic disease at all. Just trying to be a voice for those people, I think it has really propelled me into being able to do that.
Well, I think that it's important, you know, in that time of trauma is finding the gift, right? And trying to look for the gift in all the things that are brought to your life. So I know that you're a huge advocate for breast cancer. How did you get connected with Barbells for Boobs? Let's talk about kind of your history with organization.
Yeah. So interestingly enough, I found Barbells for Boobs. So I started wanting to be an advocate after my first diagnosis in 2011. And when I moved up to Montana, I started doing CrossFit, probably around 2014-ish. And I think through like social media or Facebook, I stumbled upon Barbells for Boobs, and I was like, this is great. we need to do this at our gym. And so I remember talking to the gym owners and saying, I'd really like to do one of these. I think it'd be great. And they were like, yeah, let's do it. And so that was, I think, 2015, because I was just about to start planning for an event at our box and I got diagnosed. And so what happened was one of, or many of our gym members ended up taking that over for me and put on a Barbells for Boobs event in fall of 2015. And I showed up bald. We had a dunk tank. We had people raising money.
Wow.
We had like the head of one of our state government agencies in the dunk tank. It was phenomenal. And the cool thing on top of that was that my box, and this won't surprise anybody that's with CrossFit, ended up raising a bunch of money for Barbells for Boobs and then also raising money for my treatment. And so, and I didn't know this. And so after the event, on one of the days I had to go to chemo, they broke into my house with the assistance of my brother and hid about $500 in quarters and dollar bills all over my house.
Oh my gosh.
I was finding money for like months, you know, like in the freezer, on top of the doors. So
that's incredible.
It was so cool to be able to have my first Barbells for Boobs event as a bald person and have it go so well, and then have that on top of that. And so, yeah, we just continue to do events for several years after that. And I've just been such a fan of this organization, and I love, especially right now, where it's headed. So that was where I started.
Aww,
it's just
thank you.
Cool to be, have been around for so many years.
Yeah, I've been around the block. It's crazy because, you know, I think about what we're doing now with the resources after diagnosis and how we really didn't, you know, there was a huge gap in our voice when it came to after diagnosis and us really advocating once women were diagnosed. And again, I think that a lot of the work that we're doing right now is me finding the gift in losing my sister, me saying there has to be some connection here and something bigger and a reason that her life was, you know, taken from me, like from us, from this world. Right. She was a beautiful gift to the world. And so it's like, how do I continue to shine a light and do something beautiful to kind of remember, you know, that it doesn't always have to be dark and it doesn't always have to be negative. We can always bring something positive back into this world. And, you know, we're, right. I think that we're probably more dedicated now on the resources after diagnosis because our community is so tight and everybody is just so willing to want to help women be better after breast cancer. And that's all we want to do. And it sounds like you've really taken up, taken that stance from your first diagnosis. So that's awesome.
Yeah. And you know, when I got my second diagnosis, when I came back, I was going to CrossFit, and I remember having this little notebook because I was like, I don't even know what to do. I have no idea what I can and can't do. And so I started this little notebook to try to like figure it out. And I remember on what our early support page being like, we really need like some sort of like list of what cancers people can do after they get out of treatment. And so like having the RAD program is like my dream because I just so needed that. When I was trying to get back into it, I had no idea what to do. So,
yeah. Have you seen since, I mean, for anybody out there that's listening, who knows when you're going to listen to this, it might be in 2030 because time, you know, this is the time capsule of our stories. Right now we're in quarantine as a world, depending on where you live. We're in quarantine due to the coronavirus, the COVID-19. And so one thing that this quarantine has pushed me to do is create a daily workout and a Facebook Live and for our community. So I don't know if you've seen, but we've created a Rad Wad. We're doing Facebook Live every morning or Monday through Thursday at 9 a.m. And it's, I mean, to go from just hearing from you saying at a notebook, I had no idea what to do, to now us developing this daily workout that's really meant for breast cancer survivors or if you're currently in treatment. And right now, obviously we just started it, but one of the things we want to do is I want to create the modifications to be more of where would you be at and what type of treatment. So if you're post-mastectomy, here's your modifications for today. Or if you're, you know, in chemo currently and you still want to move around, here's some modifications for the day. So just talking to some other women that have been really, really engaged and advocating as well, saying our modifications should really be more treatment focused and where you're at in your treatment. So that's come, mm-hmm. that's to come. So I'd love awesome. Any of your feedback on that since you were a student of working out as a breast cancer patient.
Yes. Well, I will tell you to do not do CrossFit baseline when you're doing radiation because, actually, you know what it was? I had just gotten my port in and I didn't understand how the healing process works. So I did CrossFit baseline and my port came out. So don't do that.
Oh, that's
it didn't actually come out. It just like the incision like opened up. So yeah.
Okay.
You know, there's a period of time where you should slow down your CrossFitting. Take a break.
There is.
Yeah.
So having two diagnoses is my next thing that I love to kind of learn from every story is I want to know what was your biggest lesson in breast cancer. I know your second diagnosis was definitely to become to be able to create a deeper understanding to help others, which I think is incredible. But overall, overarching on both diagnoses, what has been your biggest lesson from breast cancer?
Oh man, there's so many lessons, but I would say for me, the biggest one was that cancer taught me how to be the person I was always meant to be. Because of everything I went through, I sort of was able to look at myself and what I was doing and who I was, and gave myself permission to put myself first in a lot of ways, give myself value, and really make time for what matters to me. Before my first diagnosis, you know, like working out or eating healthy or spending time with loved ones might have fallen off my plate if I got busy. And, you know, with cancer, I was really like, you know what? No, I'm going to work out. I'm going to take care of myself and I'm going to be with the people that I love. And so that became important to me. So I really now can relish my time with my loved ones and be present because I know what it's like to not be able to be there or to be there and feel like crap. And that includes all the little stuff. And I feel like now I really am able to know and be the good person that I want to be and to follow my path and use my gifts and just really enjoy who I am and where my life is. And I think that it's partly related to my thoughts on like fear of recurrence and the future, because no one really knows how long they have, whether you have cancer or not. And for me, knowing that I can live being the best person or the best version of myself and being truly happy where I am is the most important, because if I only have one day left, then I'm happy with who I am and I'm okay. But if I have many, many more years left, then that's just like the icing on the cake, you know? And I think without cancer, I don't know that I would have given myself the permission to be who I am and do what I love, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, it's totally like a redemption for self-love. You know, I think that we get lost in the chaos of achievement, the chaos of this is what you need to do in your life. You graduate high school, you go to college, you get married, you have kids, you have this like linear path that I think that is preached to women specifically, really more to women as saying, this is what you're supposed to do. And I think that we're such, I don't want to say women are followers, but we are very, I think that women are more, we take direction better and we are more task oriented than men. Not to say that that's bad or anything. I just think that, you know, even talking to my dad, he's like, I loved my girls, or talking to my coaches, like, I love coaching girls because you know how to take direction. You're hard workers. You put the work in. And I think that we if we are human beings like that, if women are like that, and we're told this our whole life of here's what success looks like, we're just going to try to keep working on that. Right. And so I think being able to be okay, say, hey, I see this line that everyone's telling me about, but I'm going to step to the right a little. And I'm going to go down this other line and this other path. And I'm going to try these other things, that it's really hard to just do that without having trauma creating the reason that you leave the line. That makes any sense, right? Like you are deciding to say, you know what? This line is nice, but it's not for me anymore. And it's okay. And right. I don't care about the judgment or the shame that's going to be associated with me doing my own thing now or taking care of myself. Mm-hmm. Or who cares if you think if I'm at the gym too long or all these things.
And it's exactly that. And it's the whole idea of like, oh yeah, I'll get to it eventually. You know, I'll be that person eventually, or do what I want to do eventually. And when you are faced with cancer, you're like, okay, well, eventually could mean different than what I assumed it would mean. So what does that look like for me? And I think being able to be like, all right, this is who I am. This is where I want to stand on this line, or steps to the side of the line. Or, I mean, this is what I'm doing today because, you know, I need to live my best life today. And that's ultimately what's most important.
It's like breast cancer is the truth teller. Let's really see who you are.
Yeah.
Really testing who you are.
I did this advocate training last summer for young advocates with breast cancer. And their first question was, is cancer a gift? And it was, you had to choose yes or no. And it was interesting how many people chose yes. And obviously it's not a gift in a lot of reasons, but you know, someone asked me why I said yes. And I said, because I am a better person today than I was 10 years ago. And that's absolutely true. With how I treat myself and how I treat other people, I'm a better person because I've been through cancer.
I think that if we can't find the gift in this, and however we're impacted by breast cancer or cancer in general or chronic disease or anything that's going to basically anything that attacks you that you have no control over. That's the one thing that we all understand is we have no control over. The only thing we have control over is our attitude, how we respond to this, how we show up, how we love ourselves, how we love others. And I think that that's the common root that we all understand is I couldn't control what cancer was doing to my best friend or my sister. I couldn't control that it was, you know, attacking their bodies or making them sicker or, you know, putting them to rest in peace. You know, I couldn't control those things, but what I could control was how I responded to those things. And I think that you have to change your mindset. And I think that that's why so many of us we have to find the gift, because if we don't find the gift in all of this, that's scary to me to even understand what that would look like for me if I couldn't find the gift, you know?
And for me, it's like, cancer's not going to win. And I think by allowing cancer to take things from me and make me feel horrible all the time, that's what to me makes it feel like cancer wins. And so from my perspective, I'm like, no, you're not going to take away my life. You're not going to take away my happiness and my joy. And mm-hmm. so that's what it, you know, that's what it comes down to, is that you kind of choose how you're going to move on. And for me, I'm like, oh, screw you, because I'm going to have a good life. Thank you.
Yeah, no, and I think that what ends up happening is there are things that it takes from you that you really don't have control over. Like, it changes your body. And that is our body image as women is already, we're already a mess about it. And so now you're going to add something else on to, again, change my body image. And I have no control over that. And I'm going to gain weight, or I'm going to be inflamed, or I'm going to be, you know, just, I'm going to have hot flashes, or I'm not going to be able to sleep. Like, all these things happen to your body that you have absolutely no control over. And again, I think that what we're doing when it comes to, hey, let's just at least move, because we can control that with our bodies. We can get up and right. walk around the block, or we can change the way that we eat and our eating habits, even though maybe on certain chemos, certain things don't taste good or are great, you know, but let's figure out yep. the good things that we can stomach and we can put in our system. So I think that a lot of things that we're working on right now when it comes to physical activity and nutrition and just overall support on the RAD, you know, on the resources after diagnosis side is I think that we're trailblazing a path right now, because I can't find mm-hmm. a lot of information out there right now for women.
I know. So. And I think like you said, you know, when you're diagnosed, you feel like there's a lot of things you can't control. And for me, you know, diet, nutrition, exercise is something I can do. And so it's so empowering mm-hmm. for me to be able to be like, you know what? I don't know what's going to happen down the road, but I am doing everything I can to be as healthy as possible and reduce my risk of recurrence by eating well, working out, and doing everything like that. I think we're going to see a lot more information come out about the importance of, you know, exercise and nutrition when it, you know, when it comes to breast cancer. But one of the things I'm going to write someday is how CrossFit literally saved my life, because of not only like the mental stuff, but like the physical stuff. And then also like the bone density and like the weightlifting, like it's all just so important. And I know it's like a cliche thing to say, but I'm like, seriously though, I'm going to write it someday.
I think that that's a testimony that so many of us have, that CrossFit saved our life. And I'll share this because I think it's, I remember I spoke with a representative of CrossFit, really, you know, kind of been there forever. And I remember telling him, you know, the same thing, CrossFit saved my life. And he told me, CrossFit didn't save your life, Z. A CrossFit affiliate saved your life. Mm-hmm. And it was really humbling to hear that from somebody at CrossFit headquarters, that they realize how important the affiliates are. And really that's where the work was done. And that's what he told me. He was like, the work was done by your affiliate. The work wasn't, I mean, mm-hmm. he's like, we're a fitness program, you know, like we provide great, you know, a fitness program. But at the end yeah. of the day, what saved your life was your community. What saved your life was the accountability. What saved your life was somebody taking the risk to open up a gym in your neighborhood so you had access to that community. You know, all these things that laddered back to affiliates are who are saving people's lives. It was such yeah. a like aha moment for me. I was like, oh, you're right. He's like, so don't ever say that CrossFit saved your life. And I'm like, nope, I mean, I'm still going to say it.
Totally. I mean, when you say that, like I think about the gym owners and the members that stood by me while, you know, I couldn't do things or I needed help, or, you know, the story about them coming to my house, like that's the part that makes me tear up, because those people, like, they care. And there's just so, they're just mm-hmm. really important.
Yeah, they are. And I think that anybody going through this needs that kind of community, you know, and that's where we want to, if you don't have one locally, that's at least Barbells for Boobs can start becoming that community on a global scale, to say if somebody gets diagnosed, they don't have access to an affiliate, or they're too, you know, they're too sick to even go into an affiliate, that we can still provide that type of support at large.
Yep. So. Yeah, absolutely.
All good stuff.
Yeah.
Is there anything else that you would like to share with our community? Anything that we didn't touch on?
You know, the only thing that I would say that is kind of my thing is just that I have a science background, and obviously I do a lot of advocacy work, and I think that research is really important. And so one of the things that I do is I review grant applications for breast cancer funding, which is really important to me. But just like the idea that a lot of people look behind them, like look to the past when they start thinking about a diagnosis and what's going to happen and are they going to survive? And I really think that we need to be thinking about the future, or at least looking forward in a little bit more of a positive direction, because I just really believe that the treatment of people in the future, whether that's years from now or days from now, are going to look different than they did in the past. And so I want people to remember that hope. You know, that doesn't always have to be as bad as it used to be. Like, I just really believe that someday this is going to be better. And I really hope that for everyone touched by breast cancer, whether it's stage zero or metastatic disease, I think that research is going to play a really important role.
I couldn't agree more. And I think that already you look at the things that research has done for breast cancer, and, you know, let's rewind 30 years ago and women were hiding breast cancer from their husband. And today I can run an organization with the word boobs in it and talk about it so freely and so openly. And that took a lot of research. That took a lot of women trailblazing the path that we're all on right now. And saying, no, this, you know, this is a big deal. We need to, this is killing women. This is killing moms. This is killing sisters and daughters. And we really need to be a little bit stronger in the way that we present this for the future generation, for our daughters and, you know, for that future. And so I think that not only in the research side, but even on the support side, you know, I think that the research, obviously, you look at how women were even screened 30 years ago, and it makes me want to throw up how women were screened. But like, at least we have guidelines and some rights now to our breast screening, which is phenomenal. But even the support. So, for example, 2011, when you were diagnosed, there was no information about exercising and you started doing your own research, you know? So I think that even we're doing some type of research by even putting this information out there, because this information is not out there to say, hey, at what point can I start getting my pull-up back after a double mastectomy?
Yeah.
Like, you can't just Google that right now.
Right.
So that we can make it better if the next woman gets diagnosed. Hey, we've got a plan here. Here's an entire progression. Here's where you should be at week 12.
Yeah. Absolutely. It's really important. Yeah, I agree.
Very important.
No, on both sides. On both sides. Keep doing what you're doing. And, you know, I'm really encouraged too that people are talking about metastatic breast cancer. I think that that's a relatively new thing that's urgently needed. So keep doing it. I'll keep doing it.
Well, I think that that's it. Yeah. I think that the metastatic is, I think that because we're getting more vocal and because we have access like social media, people are hearing this, they're just learning more about the disease. Right. And we're getting a little bit more exposure about it. And I think that we can kind of close the show on this message. I learned this very, probably like 7 years ago, a woman at the YSC summit came up, shared her story. First diagnosis was like a stage zero. Second diagnosis was stage four. And she kind of educated us on, why aren't we talking about breast cancer the way that we talked about AIDS in the 80s? Like, women are dying and we're painting a pretty pink ribbon around this. And why aren't we kind of saying and show, like, there was literally billboards of people dying and that's how we talked about AIDS and HIV.
But in
breast cancer, for some reason, we're too scared to talk about that women die. But it's actually happening. And so she was really advocating, like, we need to talk about this more. This is probably the most important topic in breast cancer. And it was the first time that I was really exposed to stage four. And then literally like 2 months later, my sister was diagnosed with stage four. So again, all these things happen in your universe to prepare you for whatever's coming next. But I agree. I think that stage four is something that's going to really be put more at the forefront in our community.
Excellent.
So where can the people find you? Are you on the Instas? You're on the Facebooks? You want to share with them your handles for Insta? I know you're private, but that's okay. We're still going to share it.
Oh, that's okay. I accept some friends. Michelle McGree on Facebook. I'm on Instagram, Michelle Maureen 13. I actually got a Twitter account for advocacy work because I felt like it was a good way to be able to report on things that I was seeing, which is at @M_the_survivor. And yeah, that's pretty much it. I probably use Facebook, Instagram mostly, but when it comes to advocacy work and breast cancer, I use the Twitters.
Twitter's always good for your people's opinions.
Yeah.
So
I don't really know that much about there. It, but I know how to read stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. Like where everybody talks all the shit is on Twitter. That's all I know about Twitter.
Totally good. I'm talking the breast cancer shit on Twitter.
Yeah, perfect. We're talking the real shit on Twitter. Come join us. All right. Michelle, thank you so much for sharing your story. This is the first time our podcast has had somebody on with a reoccurrence, I believe. I believe this is our first show with a reoccurrence. So thank you so much for opening up and sharing that story. And remember, everyone out there, that enjoy who you are. Enjoy, like, have some grace with yourself. This is the lesson of this podcast today. Be the person you were meant to be. Whether you're living with breast cancer, whether you're not, don't let it take a breast cancer diagnosis to just to be who you are and show up for yourself. Those are words right from our friend Michelle. Thanks for joining in today. And that's Lights Out.